change their votes. And so far, public polling has found this bill to be pretty unpopular. Democrats have had a lot of success in branding it as a tax cut for the rich at the expense of the poor and the vulnerable. A senior White House official conceded in a call yesterday with reporters that the president and Republicans are going to have to educate the public on what's actually in the bill, including things that are popular, like no tax on tips or expanding the child tax credit. And another thing to watch is the Medicaid cuts in the bill, which an independent analysis found would cause nearly 12 million people to lose coverage. Those will phase in more slowly, which may give Republicans some political cover, because people often don't draw a direct line between things happening in their lives and something politicians in Washington passed years earlier.
Yeah, now, still a lot of uncertainty, though. Various global conflicts, the U.S. tariff policy. What challenges lie ahead, though?
Well, it depends on how you feel about tariffs. Early next week, Trump's tariff pause is set to end, and his administration has not had much success striking trade deals. So he says he's just going to start sending letters to countries telling them how high their tariffs will be going forward. Economists say tariffs are going to hit American consumers, but Trump is unconcerned. Trump is also burning up the phones to various world leaders trying to wind down the conflicts in Gaza and Ukraine. And then there's Iran. All of which is to say, a president's work is never done.
NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Key, thanks.
You're welcome.
Now that we've heard how the White House and congressional Republicans are celebrating their big legislative win, let's hear from the Democrats. Representative Catherine Clark of Massachusetts is the Democratic whip, meaning she's the top leader just behind Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, and she's with us on the line now. Good morning, Congresswoman. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Michelle.
So Leader Hakeem Jeffries gave a marathon speech against the Republicans' bill for more than 8 hours yesterday. He called the bill disgusting, an abomination, which is an opinion, frankly, shared by many Democrats and some Republicans. And polls have found that more people oppose the bill than support it. And yet, here we are. The president plans to sign the bill today. Why do you think the Democrats weren't able to stop it when they had public opinion on their side?
Because the currency for the House Republicans is they care about one constituent, and that's Donald Trump. And at the end of the day, despite all their misgivings, all the lies that have been peddled about the benefits of this bill, they put aside their very real concerns about kicking 17 million people off of healthcare, and they voted to show their loyalty to Donald Trump. And on the 4th of July, when we celebrate our freedom and fighting for opportunity for everyone, the idea that they have shackled American families with a high cost of living and are going to further drive up their costs of health care and food and erode their public schools, and all the while adding $4 trillion to our national debt, it is such a cruel irony that they are signing this bill when we should be celebrating our independence.
So for clarity, the Congressional Budget Office, which is this nonpartisan group that scores the bill, said it's about 12 million people would lose their health insurance at some point, and they added those deficit increases at about $3.3 trillion, which is still big, but just for clarity, those are the numbers that I think people have heard more often than that. Republican Congressman Mike Lawler of New York told All Things Considered he thinks Americans will like the bill in the long run. Let's listen to what he said.
When people are actually getting tax cuts, it will be extremely popular among the working class and the middle class and the folks who are going to benefit exceptionally well from the provisions within this bill.
So, Congressman, how are you going to deal with the fact that Americans will see tax cuts before next year's midterms and many of the cuts to their benefits only after the midterms?
You know, there are some tax cuts, and we would have loved to have a discussion about how we can reform our tax policy so that it works for working people. But that's not what this bill does. There are some short-term tax cuts, but it will never offset the damage they have done. $1 trillion out of Medicaid, $500 billion after Medicare. Those were promises that Donald Trump and the Republican made to never touch those programs. And it goes so much deeper. I have heard from constituents, you know, there's one mom named Nancy and her son Charlie, who's dependent on Medicaid for Charlie's disabilities to be able to have a wheelchair, to have aids. And with Medicaid's help, he is learning to walk. They have just ripped that away from that family and millions of other families. And, you know, the cuts are not only to Medicaid, but to the ACA, closing hospitals. There are 330 hospitals that they have just put in real jeopardy. That's not only access to healthcare, especially for rural America. Those are jobs. They're often the largest employer in a region. So this bill overall is, I cannot overstate the cruelty and what is going to happen to the American people as these provisions take place.
I understand, but what I'm asking you is, how are you going to talk about this going forward? Look, I understand that the Democrats are looking to the midterms, as they logically would. I mean, the president's party has lost the House majority in, what, 4 of the past 5 midterm elections, including the most recent 3. So it's logical that the Democrats would look toward the midterms. But what I'm asking you is, how are you going to talk about that when the actual pain of this is unlikely to be felt before the midterms, where the benefits are likely to be felt or may be felt?
You know, I think that they are going to feel this. We're already seeing hospitals that are saying, looking ahead at Medicaid reimbursement, they are looking to close. We've already seen reports of that. And House Democrats are going to spend every day of the next 16 months talking to moms and dads and seniors and veterans, so that they know that Republicans just took away their health care, raised their energy bills, and hiked their grocery costs. And we're going to continue doing our shadow hearings, going into communities across this country, talking about this bill and what its impact is going to be. And our vision for Americans, where we give them the tools for success, so that they can build a life of dignity. That's what Democrats are going to be doing. This is not what the American people voted for, and they are not going to forget this outright betrayal.
Let me mention, we've invited many Republican lawmakers to talk about the bill, especially members who came around to supporting it after first raising objections to it. I want to say that those invitations remain open. But to that end, a recent NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll found Republicans largely approve of the job their own party is doing in Congress, while Democrats are evenly divided. Only 44% of Democrats said they approve of congressional Democrats. Why do you think that is?
You know, I think we are living in a time where it is very difficult in Washington, that it is a winner-take-all system. And what we are doing, what we are building with the American people, is going out into their communities, holding the town halls, making sure that we are doing hearings that are there so that we can make the case for the American people, that we see you. We want you to have a fair shot at the American dream.
Okay. That is House Democratic Whip Catherine Clark. She's a Democrat from Massachusetts. Whip Clark, Congresswoman Clark, I hope you'll come back and talk more about this. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Thanks for listening to Wisconsin Public Radio on this 4th of July morning. Coming up on the show, the majority of satellite internet traffic goes through Starlink, an Elon Musk company. More on how Starlink became so dominant and whether it can stay that way. Plus, on today's Wisconsin Life, we've got a perfect story for the 4th of July about embracing new traditions and swimming in the lake in the summer. Stay with us.
WPR is a valuable resource in Wisconsin, with support from taxpayers, business sponsors, and voluntary contributions from tens of thousands of individuals and families.
We can't say it enough.
Thank you so much for your generosity.
Thank you.
Thank you for your support.
Thank you for your support.
Thank you for your generosity.
Thanks for your support and generosity.
Thank you so much.
We are so grateful.
Life in Wisconsin is richer with your support of WPR programs. Thank you.
Support for WPR comes from the Rahr West Art Museum in Manitowoc, presenting Gary Grissel, Resurrection, The Lowborn, The Neglected, and The Ephemeral. June 8th through July 20th, rahrwestartmuseum.org.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Kenosha County ADRC has new needs for its durable medical equipment loan and supply closet, including shower chairs, bariatric commodes, wheelchairs, and incontinence pull-ups. To donate, call the ADRC at 262-605-6646.
In weather for the 4th of July holiday today, we're seeing a few showers and storms this morning around the state. This afternoon, it will be sunny and very hot and humid. There is an extreme heat warning in place for Burnett, Washburn, Sawyer, Bayfield, and Douglas counties. That goes until 8 p.m. tonight. High temps will be in the upper 80s in the north and the low 90s in the south. Tonight, it'll be mild and muggy with lows around 70. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Many small religious colleges are in trouble. Enrollments are down, budgets are not balanced, and some people are skeptical about higher education and religion. Almost 80 nonprofit colleges have closed or merged since 2020, and more than half were religiously affiliated. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports on two Catholic colleges in Iowa that decided to merge and join the trend of religious schools seeking strength in numbers.
Tonight, the Mount Mercy Mustangs face off against the St. Ambrose Bees in men's volleyball. The Mustangs have home turf here in Cedar Rapids, and they're having a great season. But the Bees are hanging in. The first set is a nail-biter, 20-25. These two Catholic colleges, about 90 minutes away from each other in eastern Iowa, are rivals. But they're also quite similar. They're small and private, they're religious, and they've each been around for a century. Ultimately, Mount Mercy crushed St. Ambrose. But while they compete against each other, coming together, it might actually end up saving them.
We have watched peer institutions right around us shut their doors.
Amy Novak is the president at St. Ambrose University.
Cardinal Stritch was in our athletic conference, and Trinity International was in our athletic conference, and Iowa Wesleyan is not far from either of us and recently closed.
A mix of financial and demographic challenges are at play. Fewer high school graduates means fewer college applicants, especially in rural areas and especially in the Midwest. There has also been a long decline in the share of adults who consider themselves religious.
To watch universities close across the heartland because we can't make it work will leave our communities fallow.
It's not that either school is in trouble yet.
Both of us had reasonably good balance sheets.
They both had good endowments.
So we were really trying to say, how do we do this before it gets really bad?
The presidents of these two rival schools decided to meet on neutral territory at a Perkins restaurant. Turns out Mount Mercy's president, Todd Olson, was of similar mind.
We were certainly not at the edge of closing, but we were looking at a multi-year model that said, it's going to be hard for us to sustain this.
As more religious colleges close or face financial trouble, partnerships, shared services, and other kinds of alliances appear to be the saving grace. And Olson was interested, and he was willing to be out of a job to do it.
It was clear to me that the time to pursue this was when we didn't yet absolutely need to pursue this.
Together, they wrote the seeds of the merger on a napkin. One president, one administration, one combined library system to cut down on costs, and they'd expand academic offerings since each college has different program strengths. That plan will go into effect in 2026.
So in this scenario, we have a patient who has severe respiratory distress.
On the day we visited Mount Mercy's campus in Cedar Rapids, first-year nursing students were practicing patient simulations.
Chloe, which one needed to be given first?
Albuterol.
Professor Kathy Penn was leading the assessment.
Albuterol, and why was that?
Because she needs it right now for her shortness of breath.
Both campuses have strong nursing programs, but the merger will expand their degree offerings.
The fluticasone is a corticosteroid.
Mount Mercy, for instance, offers a master's and a doctorate in nursing. St. Ambrose offers a master's program in physician assistant studies and a doctorate in occupational therapy.
What do you like about this campus?
I love how small it is and how connected everything is.
Junior Elena Bina walks with me and producer Janet Wujong Lee out of the nursing building and across campus. She's wearing a gold horse necklace.
This is Sally the Mustang. So that's our mascot.
Mount Mercy was her first college choice. She loves the culture. There's only about 1,500 students here.
It's very peaceful.
Like a lot of students we talk to, Bina found the idea of combining with St. Ambrose nerve-wracking.
Knowing that it's not just Mount Mercy anymore is like kind of hard.
Why is it hard? That's just an identity change. It's like not what you signed up for. Like, what is hard about it?
You come to a school and you know that it's going to be Mount Mercy. Then you have to think about it like, oh, it's going to change.
On St. Ambrose's campus in Davenport, Iowa, which hosts about 2,500 students, school spirit also runs deep.
Go Bees all the time, yeah.
More than half of the students here play organized sports.
I really wanted to find a place where I could swim and study engineering, and this was the only place that offered me both.
Khalil Ruiz is a senior at St. Ambrose, originally from Ohio. Swim team defined his college experience, and it's how he met his girlfriend, Riley Steinkamp, who got him involved in campus ministry.
Honestly, it's more rare for me to find someone who's not a student-athlete, so.
They both hold up their pinky fingers and smile at each other.
We're the fighting bees, so we pinkies up,
stingers up.
Go Bees.
How could the bees cheer for the Mustangs and vice versa? Well, they won't have to. One of the key aspects of the merger, they'll keep two sports teams, two mascots, to preserve each campus's separate identity. Combining teams, Todd Olson knew,
that would not be wise at all from a business perspective. It is a powerful enrollment driver.
Ruiz and Steinkamp will be back next year cheering for the Bees. And they're also happy that the traditions of St. Ambrose, like 9 p.m. Wednesday Mass at the chapel, the school's most popular, will be safeguarded by this new partnership. The two swimmers join about 100 other students.
Holy, holy, holy Lord.
Tonight, they pray
for the anxious and the afraid,
for the poor and the hungry,
Lord, hear our prayer,
and for the upcoming merger,
for St. Ambrose and Mount Mercy University, that the grace of the Holy Spirit may help us to follow God's plan for our new partnership. We pray to the Lord.
Whether or not it's God's plan,
Lord, hear our prayer.
Campus leaders believe it's a necessary plan, and hopefully one that will ensure both campuses are around for another 100 years.
Amen.
Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News, Eastern Iowa.
Alyssa's story was produced in partnership with the Hechinger Report, a nonprofit independent news organization, and with reporting help from James Kelly at Iowa Public Radio. This is NPR News.
Sometimes a song isn't just a song. It's an idea, a rallying cry, or even an expression of identity. This Independence Day, we'll revisit our 2018 series looking at the music that helped make America.
Whenever I hear it, it stops me in my tracks, and it makes me reflect on the goodness of man.
I'm Elsa Chang, looking back at our American Anthem series on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered here on WPR from 3 to 6:30.
This is WPR News.
Coming up on Wisconsin Public Radio, we've got a Wisconsin news update. Higher meat prices mean Wisconsinites will be paying more for a summer cookout this year. We'll have the details in just a few minutes.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump is praising Republicans in Congress for giving final passage to the massive GOP tax and spending cut bill. As NPR's Stephen Fowler reports, the president traveled to Iowa last night, hours after the legislation was approved by the House.
Trump's address was meant to kick off a year of celebrations for America's 250th anniversary next year. But he primarily celebrated his administration's achievements, like the reconciliation bill passed hours earlier.
There could be no better birthday present for America than the phenomenal victory we achieved just hours ago when Congress passed the one big, beautiful bill to make America great again.
Trump is expected to hold a signing ceremony this afternoon at the White House. Stephen Fowler, NPR News.
The package cleared the Senate earlier this week on a tie-breaking vote by Vice President Vance. Firefighters in Central California say the state's largest wildfire of the year is burning out of control in San Luis Obispo County. It's burned nearly 53,000 acres since it broke out on Wednesday. It's being fueled by hot, dry conditions and has forced some residents to evacuate. Containment is at 10%. Russia's latest drone and missile attack on Ukraine is being called the largest aerial assault by Moscow of the war. This is NPR News from Washington.
And this is news from Wisconsin Public Radio at 8:31. Good morning. I'm Bridget Bowden. Higher meat prices mean Wisconsinites will be paying more for summer cookouts this year. The Wisconsin Farm Bureau's survey of grocery store prices found a meal for 10 people cost just over $69. It's about 4% higher than the same report last year. The price of ground beef was up nearly 7%, and pork chop prices also increased. Cassie Sunentag from the Wisconsin Farm Bureau says the state's prices are still below the national average.
We have always seen pretty low prices on a lot of these items on the survey, and that's just because we have a very diverse agriculture industry in this area.
The national average for the survey of 12 food items totaled just under $71, about the same as last year. Wisconsin has a new two-year state budget signed into law early Thursday morning. It includes a cut to state income taxes, a priority of Republicans, and it puts more money toward child care subsidies and education, which Democratic Governor Tony Evers had sought. The budget also includes a reduction of 300 state jobs. Most of those cut positions come from not filling vacancies, especially at Veterans Affairs. Some came from expiring projects. And a handful took aim at specific positions at the Office of Clean Energy and the Office of Environmental Justice. The overall reduction was partly offset from new jobs created elsewhere, especially at the Department of Corrections, and by the hiring of dozens of new prosecutors. The world's largest fencing tournament is happening in Milwaukee this week. It's the USA Fencing National Championship. More than 6,000 fencers are competing in almost 100 events at the Baird Center downtown. Some are team events, others are open to sign-ups from individual athletes. The tournament goes through Monday, July 7th. It's free and open to the public. In weather today for the 4th of July holiday, we're seeing a few showers and storms across the state this morning. This afternoon, it will be sunny and very hot and humid. There's an extreme heat warning in place for Burnett, Washburn, Sawyer, Bayfield, and Douglas counties. That goes until 8 p.m. tonight. High temperatures will be in the upper 80s in the north and the low 90s in the south. You can find more news online anytime at WPR.org. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. There's news of a potential deal on sharing the Colorado River. About 40 million people from Los Angeles to Phoenix to Denver and beyond rely on the Colorado for drinking water. It also irrigates fields that grow food for most of America, but it's also shrinking because of climate change. Alex Hager reports on the river for KUNC in northern Colorado and is with us now to tell us more about it. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning.
So the current agreement for how states share the Colorado is now more than 100 years old, and the federal government set a deadline for a new one to be signed by next year. Now, you've reported that it has seemed unlikely that they'd meet that deadline, but now you're telling us it looks like they might?
Yeah, like you said, climate change is making the river smaller, and the states that use it, they know they have to use less, but they have been stuck on one big question. You know, who exactly should have to cut back? You've got the mountain states where the river starts. That's Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and New Mexico. And the downstream states, California, Arizona, and Nevada. And for more than a year now, talks between those two groups had basically been at a total standstill.
But your sources involved in the negotiations are telling you that the states in the upper and lower basins have now reached some kind of a compromise.
Yeah, up until now, states were really digging in their heels. Some of them were trying to find legal loopholes that would let them skirt around big new cutbacks. Some were trying to stick to century-old rules that were written when the river had a lot more water in it. But now we are seeing a big shift in philosophy. They are considering a new plan that would look at how much water is actually in the river each year and give each side a percentage of that. And this is a pretty big deal. The top water negotiator in Arizona said before he was worried the states would end up in big, messy lawsuits. Now he says he's optimistic they are going to avoid that.
Well, that is big. So while the states have been sorting out their differences, the Trump administration in June tapped the new person to represent the federal government in this process. His name is Ted Cook. He was nominated to run the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. What do we know about him?
Well, Cook spent more than two decades with the Central Arizona Project, which brings water from the Colorado River to Phoenix and Tucson. And by all accounts, he is a qualified technical expert. People who worked with him say he's thorough and deliberative and a good mediator for negotiations like the ones we're seeing now. But some people are a little worried. Those upstream states are concerned he could be biased. Basically, they don't want the top federal agency for the Colorado River being run by a guy who spent his whole career on one side of the debate about how to share it.
I want to mention that Cook still faces confirmation by the Senate. By the way, has he had anything to say about concerns that he may be biased?
Yeah, he did. I got in touch with him over the phone, and he said, look, if we want someone with intimate knowledge of the Colorado River in the federal government, it will inherently have to be someone who has worked on it before, which probably means someone who has worked on one side of debates about the river.
I don't really appreciate being prejudged by folks saying, oh, he's just going to be a lower basin or an Arizona partisan. I call that projection.
There's no confirmation hearing for Cook scheduled quite yet, but in the meantime, states are still meeting pretty frequently. They are starting to agree in principle about sharing this smaller river. But figuring out exactly how much each state gets, that is going to be the next big question.
That is Alex Hager with member station KUNC. Alex, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Elon Musk's business empire has had a rocky year so far, with one notable exception. Most satellite internet traffic goes through his satellite internet service, Starlink. How did Starlink become so dominant, and can it stay that way? Our colleagues Darian Woods and Waylon Wong at The Indicator report.
Starlink is the satellite internet service provided by SpaceX. You buy one of these terminals, which looks kind of like a silver iPad. You set it up facing the sky, and then almost anywhere in the world, you can have high-speed internet.
Satellite communications analyst Tim Farah says Starlink is top dog.
So Starlink has over 7,000 satellites in orbit today. The next biggest system is OneWeb, which has just over 600 satellites launched to date.
So how did one company become the provider of satellite internet? A big explanation is what's known as fixed costs. These are the costs before you add on more customers. So let's go through what's required to get the very first customer onto satellite internet.
You need licenses from the Federal Communications Commission.
Then you have to build satellites.
Back of the envelope, we'll probably need a couple of dozen satellites to ensure continuous service.
Then you find a rocket to get it up there. And even then, you're not done. You need to have a factory to build what's called a terminal. This is what the user has, basically the satellite dish and the modem.
So between the licenses, the satellites, and the terminal factories, the fixed costs of satellite internet are really high. What is cheaper is what's known as the variable costs. Once you've added one customer, you've got one customer in place, adding a second or a third one doesn't cost you that much extra.
What's interesting about industries with those characteristics is that these tend to be natural monopolies. That means the more customers a company gets, the cheaper it becomes for them to provide that service. One company naturally becomes a monopoly.
And so we wanted to know, is Starlink a natural monopoly for satellite internet?
Yes, I think that's right. It's a natural monopoly in satellite communications, very clearly.
Starlink wasn't the first internet satellite company, but it's been the first to really invest at this enormous scale and make it accessible to everyday people.
And because Starlink is owned by SpaceX, that means cheaper rocket launches than the prices its competitors have to pay.
So with more satellites in orbit, that gives you more bandwidth. The more bandwidth you have, the more customers you can have. And the more customers you have, that helps you bring down costs through the magic of what's called economies of scale. Having a dominant company innovating and using those economies of scale is all well and good until that monopoly does begin to care about profits and raises prices on customers who have no other choice. That's why a lot of utilities like power and natural gas are regulated by the government. There are limits to how much they can squeeze customers.
Then there's the question of how much power one unelected person should hold. Elon Musk refused to let Ukraine extend Starlink to the contested territory of Crimea. Ukraine has been frustrated with this. Its military uses Starlink.
For partly this reason, China and the European Union are encouraging their own satellite internet. But any competitors have to grapple with the fact that Starlink is part of Elon Musk's empire. And that means the usual principles of finance don't apply. Waylon Wong,
Darian Woods, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward.
This is NPR News.
Thanks for joining us here on Wisconsin Public Radio on this July 4th holiday. Still to come this hour on the show, a New York City hotel that became a symbol of the massive wave of immigration under the Biden administration is permanently closing. And for Independence Day, NPR's Morning Edition asked listeners to define freedom. Those stories are coming up this hour. Then we'll have the news at 9 o'clock here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
PBS Wisconsin Education and the Wisconsin School Music Association have partnered with music educators to create ReSound, Songs of Wisconsin, a free collection of classroom media resources featuring contemporary Wisconsin musicians. The collection is designed to help general music educators and learners explore the connections between music, culture, identity, and emotion. Access lesson plans and more. Visit pbswisconsineducation.org.
Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin DNR, celebrating the 125th anniversary of the Wisconsin State Park System. Details on all 50 Wisconsin State Parks at dnr.wi.gov.
Join us this coming Saturday morning at 11:15 for the WGTD Radio Theater's rebroadcast of The Enigma Covenant, a World War II thriller. That's this coming Saturday morning at 11:15.
It's Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's some of what's happening in the news today. Forecasters say for the first time in more than six decades, more immigrants are likely to leave the U.S. than come in this year. Experts say the demographic shift could affect the economy. And the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to hear two cases in the fall from Idaho and West Virginia that test state laws banning transgender women and girls from participating in sports at publicly funded institutions. Also, Ukraine scrambled to defend itself from Russia's largest barrage of missiles and airstrikes on Kyiv overnight. Trump says no progress was made to end the war during a call with Putin. Some experts say it's unlikely the conflict will end this year. And Wisconsin's new two-year state budget, which was signed into law yesterday, includes a reduction of 300 state jobs. Most cut positions come from not filling vacancies. It's WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for nearly a century supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org.
Thanks for joining us for Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio on this July 4th holiday. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary-Kate McCoy with a story about embracing new experiences.
Writer Jill Sisson-Quinn and her son had a summer routine. They would go to their local lake for a chilly early morning swim almost every day. But last summer, they tried somewhere new. The experience opened Quinn's eyes to the joys of both new and old loves.
My go-to lake is Sunset in Portage County, a few minutes from my home. When my son was an infant, I planted his feet in its warm sand. I pushed him on the swing while he alternately dozed and watched green darners, belted kingfishers, and bald eagles. Even as, over the years, Sunset's water level rose, swallowing the beach, engulfing the swing set, and turning the picnic tables into strange diving platforms, we continued our near-daily summer visits. They began in late May, when I'd returned from my morning walk to my son waiting on the porch in his swim trunks. We'd arrive at Sunset before 8 a.m., alone but for one older couple who braved the icy water with us. But last summer, I cheated on Sunset. I enrolled my son in swimming lessons at Waupaca County's Shadow Lake, a farther drive to a more populated area. Shadows seemed a little less wild, with its slides, lifeguards, freeze pops, and flushable toilets. The water was more shallow and warm. Folks warned by summer's end there might be lots of goose poop. Cars ran visibly along a fairly busy road on the lake's western side. Because of this, I assumed there was a dam somewhere, and the lake was man-made. Gradually, we fell in love with Shadow. I watched the teenage swim instructors progress from organizing games of hula hoop tag to teaching my son the crawl. They showed him how to give himself over to the water, how a quick turn of the head and in-breath is all he really needs of the landed environment. There is something so right about watching high schoolers teach younger kids. A friend once summed it up for me. Teenagers so need to be loved, and children so love teenagers. We didn't visit Sunset for weeks. My son found a lost beach ball in the wetlands east of Shadow, and thus began pickup games of soccer before lessons. After class, he would play on the raft and the slide with whoever was there, girls and boys alike of varying ages, who barely knew each other's names, brought together by this lake. Some pretty natural things can happen at an unnatural lake, I left thinking one day, musing about my shifting love from Sunset to Shadow. But Shadow Lake is not man-made. Like Sunset, it formed in a kettle depression left by the retreat of the last glacier, where a huge chunk of ice gradually melted in the newly laid sediment. The lake's only difference is how they get their water. A hardwater seepage lake, Sunset's water comes mainly from groundwater. A drainage lake, Shadow has both an outlet and inlet, and receives water from precipitation, runoff, and another nearby lake. And both lakes have had humans' hands in them, suffered and benefited from our constant remodeling of the environment. Shadow Lake has had its channels renovated. Sunset has endured chemicals to kill off its entire fish population to be replaced with more desirable species. This reminds me that categories exist mostly in the mind. Natural, man-made, seepage, drainage, the lines between them often blurry. Nothing is pure. Passions can shift, and our preconceived ideas about one thing over another only limit our experience. After his final lesson, my son and I returned to Sunset Lake, and that original bond flooded through me like a dream of one's first love, from which you wake thinking still, this many years later, that was the one. And sunset seemed to forgive our fickleness. That day, unassisted for the first time, my son would swim all the way out to sunset's buoy, just him and the water and desire. And for that, I cannot deny, I have to thank Shadow.
Jill Sisson Quinn is an author who teaches writing at Mid-State Technical College and lives in Scandinavia, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
I'm Steve Brown, inviting you to join us this coming Saturday morning at 11:15 for the rebroadcast of the WGTD Radio Theater's The Enigma Covenant, a World War II thriller about how the British Navy captured the German Enigma machine. Support for the radio theater comes from the Brown Osterup Performing Arts Foundation. On the web at brownosterupfoundation.org. The WGTD Radio Theater, this coming Saturday morning at 11:15.
Morning edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio on this July 4th holiday. In sports, the USA Fencing National Championship is taking place at the Baird Center in Milwaukee. The tournament started on June 28th and runs through July 7th. It's free and open to the public. The Brewers lost to the Mets yesterday, 3-2. They will play the Marlins this evening just after 6. And in tennis, Novak Djokovic added another record to his name by reaching Wimbledon's third round for the 19th time yesterday. This is WPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. About 2 years ago, buses full of migrants began arriving in New York City. Now, you might remember the images, people waiting on the streets of Manhattan to be processed at the Roosevelt Hotel, which city officials had turned into an intake center and shelter. That hotel became a symbol of the massive wave of immigration under the Biden administration, and now it's closing its doors permanently. NPR correspondent Jasmine Gartz joins us now. So you're one of the few reporters allowed into the hotel. What do you remember about that time?
Oh my God, the heat. I spent a lot of time in 2023 in this really muggy New York City heat, right around this time of year. And I was in line with people who had recently been allowed across the U.S.-Mexico border and then came to New York. And one of the first people I spoke to was an Ecuadorian man named Jose Luis. He asked that his last name be withheld because he'd fled cartel violence. And he had been sleeping on the sidewalk of the Roosevelt Hotel for 4 days waiting for intake.
Nosotros lo que realmente necesitamos.
And what he told me is, look, all I'm asking for is a room to stay in until I can find work, and then I'm going to get my own place.
Now, these people are coming a long way from at least the southern border all the way to New York. So how are they getting to the Roosevelt?
Yeah, so a lot of it was word of mouth. You know, people had been told there were jobs and there was shelter in New York. But also, Texas Governor Greg Abbott sent over 37,000 immigrants to New York City on buses as like a political statement. In some ways, this was a crisis by design.
Now, you spent a lot of time inside the actual hotel, the Roosevelt. What did you see in there?
It was so wild to be in there. It's like a very swanky 1920s style hotel with chandeliers and wide staircases. And then there were also interpreters, healthcare workers scrambling to help. It really did feel like a modern day Ellis Island. And the families I spent time with were extremely eager to get jobs and move on with life. You know, one of my favorite reports that I've ever done was about a Girl Scout troop for migrant kids living in shelters like Roosevelt.
Make new friends, but keep the old.
And that's the troupe singing. It was a bunch of 9 and 10-year-old kids who'd done these very traumatic long treks up Latin America through the Darien Gap and were now learning English and American civics.
Wow. What happened to the people living at the Roosevelt?
Well, you know, soon after it opened, New York City leaders said, listen, we're overwhelmed. But this year, border crossings are at a historic low. So migrants aren't coming into shelters at the same rate. And the city says it's relocated the remaining families to other shelters.
Okay. Now, I remember the Roosevelt being like this flashpoint in public opinion on immigration. I mean, has that opinion changed since it first opened?
Yeah. You know, the hotel became a talking point for Republicans. It was discussed as a hotbed for crime. There was really no evidence of this. But at the time, a historic number of Americans, over half, felt that the U.S. needed to decrease immigration rates. A new poll out this week by NPR and PBS found that 54% of Americans feel immigration enforcement has now gone too far.
That's NPR's Jasmine Garz, an immigration correspondent for NPR. Jasmine, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
For this Independence Day, we asked our listeners to think about freedom. Here is some of what you told us.
My name is Michael Morton. I live in West Michigan, and I'm a general manager of an automotive plant. Freedom to me is, you know, the freedom to make your own way as best you can. I just wish people would slow down for a minute and think about what freedoms they have. I have the freedom, you know, to choose where I work. That's a freedom that doesn't exist everywhere in the world. I have the freedom to pick who I'm marrying, how many children I'm allowed to have. And we can disagree and we can criticize the government, and we have a lot of leeway here in this country.
My name is Tyler Roth and I live in Hood River, Oregon. Freedom to me is that everyone should be able to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Nobody should be inflicting on everyone else's thoughts, ideas, religions. Everyone should be free to express themselves. Every time I drive to work, there's a guy on the corner with a giant sign that says, God is great and looking for honks. And then there's an awesome trans lady that works at my local grocery store. There shouldn't be any reason why these can't exist together.
My name is Diane Evia Lonavie, and I live in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Freedom to me means the ability to live in a country without fear of persecution for something that you might say, who you are, who you love, what you believe in. I grew up hearing about freedom through my parents' stories from Cuba and their decision to bring my brother and me out of the country, fleeing communism. A country like ours could and should allow refugees to come in to seek asylum. And it makes me really sad. We arrived in this country 59 years ago, and we would not be admitted into this country today.
My name is Tawny Thompson, and I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So I am a member of a group called the Janesville Fife and Drum Corps. We reenact the Virginia Regiment, who would have fought in the Revolutionary War under the command of General George Washington. On the 3rd and the 4th, we get together and we do 7 parades in 2 days, and we have a color guard with flags and muskets. We have a group of fifers, and a fife is a colonial wooden flute that's very, very high pitched so that it could be heard over battlefields. I think it's important to reflect on what our founding fathers were really fighting for when they decided to rebel against King George III and England at the time, which is really just the freedom for people in this country to be able to live their lives and make choices for themselves and their families without fear of persecution.
The Janesville Fife and Drum Corps on Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music is inspired by B.J. Lederman. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Bridget Bowden. Thanks for joining us for Morning Edition on this 4th of July holiday here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We have news coming up from Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we will hear from Wisconsin Today. Stay tuned, and thanks for joining us.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Support comes from the Kenosha Community Foundation, a public charity dedicated to improving lives and strengthening nonprofits, and guiding donors like you toward tax-advantaged giving to make a positive impact on the community. Visit KenoshaFoundation.org.
Your gateway to public radio is WGTD HD1, Kenosha.